Hi, my name is Taco. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Viewpoints. On this week's show, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, a workshop explores how theater can be used to build leadership skills.
I'm taking something that I would do in an acting class and simplifying it and making it a little bit less scary for people who may not be comfortable in an acting kind of setting.
I really believe that self-awareness is a skill that you can practice.
The award-winning Poetry Walk returns to Courtney, BC with a new interactive twist.
Just looking for a way to make poetry more accessible to people and to help people understand that poetry isn't something that just sits in dusty books on a shelf somewhere, but that it can be fun and it can actually be a very interesting and heartfelt moment of human connection.
Liverpool's Astor Theatre gets a life-changing donation from the J&W Murphy Foundation.
We're thrilled to be privileged enough to be able to extend this funding that can help settle some of the swirling concerns, I think, that an organization such as the Astor has struggled with over the years. I can't think of Liverpool without the Astor. I cannot imagine the town without the Astor.
And Chris Donovan's upcoming book, The Clown Factory, explores St. John, New Brunswick's industry and community.
When I was a child, I looked up at the smokestacks and I asked my father, do they make all the world's clouds? No, he replied, they make money.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello to you all. Nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Chassai and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Today we'll hear from our journalist posted in Manitoba, Ontario, BC and Newfoundland. And we'll be leaning on the arts scene this week. First up, we're all set to tell you more about a workshop that explores how theater can be used to build leadership skills. Rachel E. Smith, a theater and film artist and educator, is no stranger to hosting such workshops. Her first workshop, held on April 8, explored communication and how strong communication stems from self-awareness. Smith presented this through physical movements combined with the theory by her co-facilitator, a music educator, Tamara Crocker. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba prepared this for us.
So we're going to take a moment to find our center. So what I would like everyone to do is to put their feet really far apart, and I want you to feel how that feels.
Rachel E. Smith, a theater and film artist and educator, is no stranger to hosting workshops. However, a suggestion from a colleague in a chance encounter at an event pulled her out of her comfort zone and into the creation of a workshop on leadership.
Well, I'm taking the tools that I already have and the exercises that I already do, and I'm just changing it into a different format. And so it's just, for me, about changing the context of it. So I'm taking something that I would do in an acting class and simplifying it and making it a little bit less scary for people who may not be comfortable in an acting kind of setting.
The first workshop of the three-part series was held on April 8th and explored communication and how strong communication stems from self-awareness.
The first thing you have to do is a version of awareness. You just have to wake up. James Clear had, I don't know if you've read James Clear's book. I haven't actually read
Smith
it.
Smith presented this through physical movements combined with theory by her co-facilitator, a music educator, and an IEA certified Enneagram coach, Tamara Crocker.
I really believe that self-awareness is a skill that you can practice. And so what I do is give people tools for that, and not just tools, but a deeper understanding of what's underneath it. I think in education, we used to teach math facts, and then we started teaching why math was the way that it was. And ultimately, we need both. We need ways that we can practice, and we need the understanding behind it.
In their presentation, Crocker utilized the theory of Maslow's hierarchy of needs to better understand how the human psyche works and help support people to develop into great leaders. Smith then brings those concepts into the physical body.
I like to bring concepts into the physical body because that's how I learn, is by bringing kind of grounding concepts. And so I really wanted Tamara to tell me what she was planning on doing so that I could come up with exercises so that we could put into practice the concepts that we were doing.
This ebb and flow of physical and theory came naturally, explained Craker, with their unique perspectives and skill sets complementing each other.
Honestly, the planning was easy. We decided we wanted to draw people in with building up their own personal leadership and helping them develop the skills that they would need to go to the next level of leadership. And we both have training in those areas that help people with that.
There, however, was one small snag. Their first workshop didn't have the numbers they anticipated, but the two were not deterred, with Craker saying it was a learning experience.
Nothing is the way you expect it to be the first time around. So there will always be, it's the first time you've done it. So either your slides won't work or people won't come or your camera won't work. Something's going to happen. So you just need to be really accepting of where you're at in the process and give yourself a chance to reflect and change it next time.
With a small attendance, for Jonathan Bailey, that meant a personalized experience.
So I want to see you walking around the space as if you're really angry about something. So you can be something, you have your arms crossed.
Bailey is an entrepreneur and practitioner in sound and chromatherapy. And for him, the workshop was an opportunity for self-reflection.
I like to see where I'm at on the journey of evolution, of self-evolution, and it's been a while. Like I've go through the process of, you know, meditating, going to meditation school, and so and also to see where everybody else's perspective on self-awareness and leadership is, right?
Looking ahead, Smith and Craker said they are excited about future workshops and eager to refine their outreach to reach even more participants. I'm Ryan Funk.
Oi, meu amor, tá me ouvindo? Você tá dormindo? Tem uma coisa importante que eu queria te contar.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
We'll now head to British Columbia, where the Downtown Courtenay Business Improvement Association and Artful the Poets are both bringing the hype to the Downtown Courtenay with their third annual Poetry Walk, this to celebrate April's National Poetry Month. The Poetry Walk itself is a collaboration between 25 poets and businesses, showcasing poems painted on the windows of storefronts. And this year, festivities will have more of an interactive approach with pop-up poetry booths and live reading events. Diana Kolpak, a participating poet and event coordinator, invited journalist Heather Watson to capture the experience at one poetry booth last Saturday, where passersby were welcome to stop and chat with the poets, who would then write a poem for them to take home. Heather Watson in Nanaimo, BC.
National Poetry Month has sprung to a start in the Comox Valley with the Downtown Courtenay Business Improvement Association and Artful the Poets joining together once again. Last year, their Poetry Walk won the 2024 Best in the West Award from Business Improvement Areas of BC for inventiveness, community engagement, relationship building between business and arts, and repeatability. The event is back and bigger this year with the addition of two interactive poetry booths across town. The poetry booths invite passersby to engage directly with the art by sitting and speaking with a poet before they write a brand new poem right there for the patron to take home. For a peek into that experience, here's poet Diana Kolpak reading out the poem she has just written for local resident Caitlin Leahy at a poetry booth outside the Courtenay Library on Saturday, April 5th.
Okay, so Katie was here a little earlier, right, Katie?
Yeah.
Yeah? So, Katie, I learned from Katie that today they went and took out some money to pay for their first house, and that her dad and her mom are here too, and her dad is happy because he just had heart surgery and everything's going great, and he moved to the island just last year, right? And so I asked her to pick a postcard from a selection I have, and it's got shells on it, and she also requested that I use the words Little Red House in her poem. So this is for Katie. We leave behind a scattering of memories, dream patterns in the sands of time to remind us where our footsteps have taken us, life lessons to guide us forward.
to futures both planned and unplanned, hearts beating bright and strong, a little red house full of sunshine, so many miracles that rise as joyful songs of the everyday.
Oh my God!
I know, those are bawling.
Oh my God!
It's beautiful. Thank you so much. Anyway, it's going to go in our home.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Poet and event coordinator Diana Kolpak spoke to CHLY and CVOX at the library after that moment you just heard about the poetry walk and the poem she read for Katie.
As you've just seen, it can be quite emotional and miraculous and stunning. So, yeah, I just like to help foster creativity and bring a little joy and magic into the world.
Kolpak says that she calls herself a storyteller, but using different media, from poetry to fiction, theater, and photography to tell her stories. She says the motivation for adding live events to the Poetry Walk this year was
just looking for a way to make poetry more accessible to people and to help people understand that poetry isn't something that just sits in dusty books on a shelf somewhere, but that it can be fun and it can actually be a very interesting and heartfelt moment of human connection.
A second pop-up poetry booth will take place on Saturday, April 12th at Gladstone Brewing Company from 2:30 till 4:30 p.m. Kolpak says that compared to the library,
it'll be a different sort of crowd, and I'm looking forward to whatever that adventure turns into as well.
When asked about the experience of writing poetry on the spot, face-to-face with her audience, Kolpak said it is wonderful and a little bit terrifying, especially when they ask for rhymes.
I love the challenge of it and the thrill of it, and just like you just have those magic moments that you can't predict are going to happen, and that's what life is all about.
Another new addition to the Poetry Walk this year was a Poem Palooza, hosted at the library following the pop-up booth last Saturday, where the 25 poets involved in this year's walk each had the opportunity to perform a selection of their poetry. The Poetry Walk itself is a collaboration between those 25 poets and 25 businesses in downtown Courtney. For the month of April, each poet has an 8-line poem painted on their partner shop's window, all located around 4th, 5th, and 6th Streets, as well as Cliff and Duncan Avenues. Readings of each poem are also available to hear on the Downtown Courtney Business Improvement Association website, read by the poets themselves. The windows were painted by local artist Kelly Everill.
It's just a really interesting and, I think, forward-thinking way of bringing together business and culture. And then people can walk around all month and look at the poems on the windows, which is quite lovely.
Kolpak says that Artful the Poets meet at Artful the Gallery the first Monday of every month for live readings of poetry. So if you don't get your fill this National Poetry Month, there's plenty more to go around. Until then, enjoy rambling the streets and reading the poems, decorating storefronts throughout downtown. This is Heather Watson.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
And next week on Viewpoints, we'll have a long-form story produced by Mia Johnson, who met up with Canadian composer and playwright Britta Johnson as she talks about the musical she wrote and that grew up with her. It was first performed 9 years ago at the Toronto Fringe, and now it's moved uptown to Ed Mervish Theatre. It's called Life After.
So I lost my dad when I was about 13, and it's not like a directly autobiographical story by any means. Like, family at the on stage really isn't mine, but I started to just write a few songs later in my adolescence. I was going through another loss and just like being at funerals and eating finger sandwiches and not knowing what to do with my hands. Like, I started to write some music that I didn't know would be for a musical, but this show is about kind of coming of age through loss. You kind of exist in the mind of the 16-year-old girl in the immediate aftermath of her father's sudden death. And so those initial songs that I wrote very much out of my own life kind of from that, a musical grew that, that's about grieving and growing up, about the kind of altered state of grief. And so it started from a very personal place and it's grown into something very much outside of me. There's always a complexity to writing something that comes from something personal, but it's been the gift is that the family portrayed on stage really isn't a lot like mine, and that this loss takes a very different shape than mine. So it very quickly became something outside of me. It can be complicated to like return to those very complex emotional states, but honestly, it's mostly provided me with a lot of healing. Like, every time we work on it, the full cast, we have really open conversations about grief and what it feels like. And grief can be such a lonely thing. It was such a lonely chapter in my life that it's been a kind of beautiful thing that so much community has grown out of it. So certainly lots of complexity, but I find there's complexity in writing anything. Writing's kind of hard.
Yeah, of course. Uh-huh. Where the truth sort of comes out.
The musical opened at the Ed Mervisher Theatre in Toronto this week for a four-week run.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
And back to the arts and culture and to New Brunswick now, as we meet up with local photographer Chris Donovan. Chris, a St. John-based documentary photographer, will publish his new book this month, documenting the close proximity of wealth and poverty found in the city and the intersection of industry and community. On April 1st, Donovan's images were featured in the New York Times, the Globe and Mail, and the Washington Post. Yona Ko in St. John, New Brunswick, spoke with Donovan about his new book, The Cloud Factory, and his ongoing work to document life in the city of St. John and beyond.
The story was set to run in March 2020, and then obviously the pandemic happened, and because it wasn't breaking news, by then it was already going to be a feature story, and the story kept getting pushed and pushed for years. And then finally, the book was set to come out. And the New York Times didn't want to get scooped by a photo book because that seemed ridiculous. So they were kind of forced to run it before the book publishes, which is happening in 10 days or 11 days from now is the official book publication date. In 2018, when the neighborhood over by Pleasant City Street was bulldozed after a butane leak, I started photographing down there. And it was kind of quiet. The neighborhood was kind of quietly removed. There wasn't much media about it. And the people who had their houses bought out had allegedly signed NDAs and didn't want to talk to media. So I started talking to people who lived in houses around there that weren't bought out. What I like about photography is that it's a medium that doesn't tell you things. It shows you things and lets you kind of interpret. And it's not like forcing issues down your throat. It's like, here's what I'm seeing. Here's what you might not be seeing in your community and what I think people should have some kind of understanding about. As I gained more understanding about the world and moved away and started working for bigger newspapers and outlets, I started to like understand the links between industrialization, monopolized economies, and the experience of childhood poverty and poverty generally, and the more specifically, like the disparity of wealth that exists in St. John, where you have one of the richest area codes in the country and one of the poorest, about a 10-minute drive from one another, which I find unacceptable. So I wanted to do something about it, and I started photographing. It's about starting conversations, I hope. You know, we live in a place where the kind of conversations that are had around environmental disaster and consequence for the sake of quote unquote progress and growth are spoken about in whispers, partly because it's a company town. And I mean, a lot of my research, I'm also an academic, like a PhD student. A lot of my research is about the realities of company towns and monopolized economies. This is not like a exceptional thing in St. John. Like the company towns have this kind of culture. It's not uncommon. But what I really want out of it, like I'm not naive enough to think that pictures are going to change people's mind. I don't think that they're good at doing that. There are some like kind of iconic photographs, I think, that have the possibility to make change. But what I'm interested in doing is like making a body of work where the photographs speak to one another and create some kind of visual narrative as a whole. What I hope that they do is act as kind of a counterballast in the archive. So when you think like photographs, vernacular material, signs, books, these things like end up creating our history. And when we look back, these materials are what we use to determine what life was like at a particular time. And so the reason it's a book is that I want it to exist in that archive so that you won't be able to look back at this time and say, everybody loved the Irvings. I think there's always a new thing. And it's not always the Irvings either. Like, we live in, like, we remember we had the AIM explosion and we weren't supposed to eat our vegetables. Like, this is, I think it's important when I talk about this that I'm not just like here to hate on the Irvings. Like, I'm here to talk about capitalist extractive industrial economy and its consequences. I want to talk about our responsibility to our environment, to where we live, to the place that kind of feeds us. You know, there's this saying that, like, what we do to the environment, we do to ourselves. Anything that happens in this area, we are putting into our body. You know, it's like we're breathing it in St. John. Like, there are consequences to these actions. One of the few places left that references the indigenous name of the river, the Willistook, the beautiful river. And it's kind of like symbolic that this place is now in this battle of, you know, like, a parking lot doesn't seem like a big deal in the grand scheme of things, but it also touches on a feeling that St. Johners have, right? Like, at some point, there's going to be a straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, when I started having this conversation really in 2014, it felt like we weren't too far. And now it feels like we're really seeing the economic consequences of industrialization broadly across Canada. So, yeah, I don't know if there's a point to the work anymore like there once was, you know, and that's kind of a difficult place to be in as someone who's like making the work, where it's like, oh, I thought this could maybe be like a warning. And now maybe it's just like pictures of a city, and maybe that's fine, too. You know,
I'm going to go back to the question about the book and about the title, Cloud Factory. Can you tell me a little bit about where that title came from?
Yeah, so there's like a little mini poem in the beginning of the book that reads, when I was a child, I looked up at the smokestacks and I asked my father, do they make all the world's clouds? No, he replied, they make money. And that's from, you know, a memory I had as a child. I think I was going to like a hockey game or something as a kid, driving over the bridge, looking at the pulp mill. And it's funny, it's like a very common, this kind of like child innocent belief that they're just making clouds is held in a lot of industrial communities. I've heard people in Hamilton tell me they thought that as a kid. There's actually an artist run center in Corner Brook called the Cloud Factory that references the pulp mill there. Totally independently, they came up with that name. So it's like, you know, it's not a unique thought. And that's, I think, what's powerful about it is it like speaks to a kind of like naivety that we have as children. You know, I don't think that the book needs much text. Like, there's an essay in the back by Alain Deneau, who's brilliant. He's a professor at Université de Moncton at the Shippingen campus, and he writes mostly in French. So we translated one of his essays from one of his books called Bon de Calonne. The essay is called Irvingia, the Colony That Doesn't Speak Its Own Name. And it's, again, kind of a reference to the idea that this area was a kind of extractive colonial place, you know, a colonized place by the French and then the British. And then that tradition is then carried on by the Irving family and by other kind of extractive resource owning people.
That was Chris Donovan speaking to journalist Yona Ko in Newfoundland.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
And we close our show in Nova Scotia. The Astor Theatre in Liverpool has secured $500,000 in funding from the J&W Murphy Foundation. It's a five-year commitment that will give the Astor $100,000 each year to help beef up its programs and promotion. Lynn Cochrane is vice chair of the Astor Theatre Society. She says it's a game changer for Nova Scotia's oldest performing arts theatre. The Astor Theatre was built in 1902 as part of the historic town hall and was originally known as the Liverpool Opera House. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
The Astor Theatre in Liverpool has secured $500,000 in funding from the J&W Murphy Foundation. It's a five-year commitment that will give the Astor $100,000 each year to help beef up its programs and promotion. Lynn Cochran is vice chair of the Astor Theatre Society. She told QCCR that it's a game changer for Nova Scotia's oldest performing arts theatre.
It is significant. It's huge. This is the largest donation the theatre has ever received. yeah, we're thrilled. It will be life-changing for the theater.
Cochran said the board began discussions with the J&W Murphy Foundation about a year ago on a plan to make the Astor sustainable.
So the Murphy Foundation is giving us an opportunity to set ourselves up for future success.
The foundation was established in 2008 by the late Janet and Dr. William Murphy, longtime Liverpool residents. Dr. Murphy co-founded the thriving Mersey Seafoods in 1964. The foundation contributes to a wide variety of charitable causes, especially in Queens County. Lisa Murphy is chair of the foundation. She told QCCR that she views the donation as an investment in a cherished centerpiece of the community.
The Astor has always meant a lot both to the town and to our family. Mom was a huge supporter of the arts. If what we have done is perceived as a vote of confidence, then we're also happy about that because it's intended to be. We're thrilled to be privileged enough to be able to extend this funding that can help settle some of the swirling concerns, I think, that an organization such as the Astor has struggled with over the years, and to enable them to build on that to secure their future. And I can't think of Liverpool without the Astor. I cannot imagine the town without the Astor.
Murphy says she hopes the contribution will help the Astor secure funding from other donors and help the theater cover operating expenses.
You know, when we speak about a vote of confidence, we are saying that we're trusting the leadership of this organization to make responsible decisions about what it wants to do with it. They are in the best position to set the direction of the society. So that's not for us to say.
In the first year of the five-year commitment, Cochran says the board will work on improving its fundraising, including creating a donor database. It will also create a cohesive marketing plan to help grow the Astor's audience and its revenue. That will include a new website. Cochran says the board is in talks now with professionals in corporate fundraising and marketing and communications. And they'll work on getting the community more involved in their programming, asking people what kinds of shows they'd like to see at the Astor. The theater's board also plans to expand the Astor Academy in the second year to bring in outside theater professionals to give more training to youth and seniors. Cochran said people will likely start to see the results of the Murphy family's investment in the fall.
The board is thrilled. It's a very generous donation at a time that the theater is really going to have an opportunity to benefit from it. Hopefully make it live on for another 100 years.
The Astor Theater opened in 1902 and was originally known as the Liverpool Opera House. It hosted local and touring shows until silent films were introduced in 1917. Many Canadian and international artists have performed there over the years, including the Royal Shakespeare Company, Rufus Wainwright, and even Mr. Dress-Up. I'm Rick Conrad.
And just a reminder that you can tune into frequencynews.ca to read and listen to the stories produced by our journalists from across the country. During this federal election campaign, they get a bird's eye view of the challenges and aspirations facing Canadians at a local, provincial, and national level. They're meeting up with candidates from all parties and different provinces. For example, we learned from Dan Jones that former BC Premier Christy Clark was in Cobourg, Ontario, to support a local Liberal candidate. And from Adam Innes in Montreal that the 31-year-old Malcolm Lewis Richmond will run as the NDP candidate in NDG Westmount. He shares with Adam his views on the economy, minority rights, and his party's future. And Tonya Oregon in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland, met up with Long Range Mountains Liberal candidate Don Bradshaw, who has been a journalist on the West Coast for NTV News for decades. So that's just a tease. Lots more out there. The election campaign is heating up. Take a peek at what's going on across the country on frequencynews.ca before April 28th. And that's all for us at Viewpoints. A big thank you to our journalists this week, Mia Johnson, Ryan Funk, Heather Watson, Rick Conrad, and Yona Ko. Remember to get all our stories on frequencynews.ca. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. Radio@frequencynews.ca.